Welcome back to Generals and Napoleon, episode 63, the Napoleon movie review. Before we begin, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that if you'd like to support the podcast, please check us out on patreon.com/generalsandnapoleon. You can also give us a follow on YouTube, Spotify, Facebook, and Instagram. As always, we really appreciate your support. Now, on with the show. We have a very special guest back. I don't know. Is this the fifth or sixth time, Marcus Cribb, that you're on the show?
I think sixth. And thank you sixth, so much for keep having me back. Yeah, we've done Waterloo and Wellington and a few generals, and we're on to something quite different today.
We are indeed. This is our first movie review on Generals and Napoleon. And what film are we reviewing today?
I think it might be Napoleon by Ridley Scott.
Yes. Sir Ridley Scott.
Sir Ridley Scott. Well, if he keeps his knighthood after this.
That's debatable, yeah.
We haven't seen if Charles has seen it yet.
Right. For those of you not familiar with Marcus, he has a great Twitter page, M Crib History, right? That's the handle?
That's me on Twitter, X, whatever they want to call it these days. I'm on there doing my history thing.
Yep, and dukeofwellington.org as well. If you want to find out more about Marcus, you can check that out. And he also does Waterloo battlefield tours, and spoiler alert to the movie, Napoleon loses Waterloo once again. So that's my only spoiler. We're going to try and not do spoilers for the first 10 minutes of this review, right, Marcus?
Right, that's what we said. We'll try to do some nice movie star reviews like you used to have on TV, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty for the history nerds like you and I.
Right. So first 10 minutes, spoiler free, and then we'll kind of dive into the details of the film. Okay.
We'll do our best.
On a scale of 1 to 10, without being too harsh, like the worst movie you saw is a 1, and the best movie you've ever seen is a 10, where would you put this at?
This is low, I'm afraid. This is a 3 or 4.
Okay.
This is down there. This is down there with the low budgets that don't end up being funny. my attention's not held, and I think the problem is obviously everyone goes in with high expectations. It's Ridley Scott, it's a guy who's given us Gladiator, The Duelist, he's given us some great films.
Yep. And then, I'm a huge Ridley Scott fan. Black Hawk Down, Blade Runner, The Martian,
Martian, great film. Very funny, delivered well. But I kind of went in with Gladiator in mind because it's a historic epic. It's Joaquin Phoenix. And that's what I wanted. And, you know, ancient Rome's not my era. I know there were no chariots in the Colosseum. I know that's not how some of the characters died and things. But it's an amazing film. The movie score's amazing. It's a spectacle. The crowd's roaring for blood. I think most people like Gladiator. There's something to like about it, at least.
Indeed.
That's what this I wanted.
I agree. And I gave it a 6 out of 10 was my first initial, when I got out of the movie theater, because I took my teenage kids. They seemed to like it. I gave it a 6 out of 10, but the more I think about it, I'm leaning more like you, like a 5 or a 4.
Yeah.
And we'll get into why here in a little bit. Let's go over with some basics. Let's start with cinematography. You know, and you've worked on production sets. Did you like the lighting and the framing and the camera work?
I'd say the majority of, disclaimer, you know, I worked on mostly as, and I still sometimes do, when I work in heritage, so historic buildings, properties, and places rent us out. So that's my side, you know, making sure that things are protected or we can do certain things and working with them rather than anything too creative. But I have worked on some TV and film. So I think it is quite a nicely set piece. I think one of the stars of the show is always going to be their locations. Mm-hmm. They had historic houses, as I like to see, and places like Malta. Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful location. And that fits in really well with a couple of the battles. I think he used Malta for two different locations. There's a few that feel a bit funny. There's blatantly like an English parkland that's meant to be the south of France. And those are slightly different terrains, but you can excuse it. Excuse the field for that when it's not important. The geography there is not important to the plot. There's certainly some good special effects for doing some of the winter scenes and things like that, I thought. But what do you feel about like history often having this blue filter. They dull the colors down for anything that wasn't like set before 1960.
Yeah, I didn't like that. I didn't like the battle scenes kind of being painted with like a gray brush, like a grayscale. Mm. I didn't like that. But I thought the blocking was good. I thought, you know, the overhead look of Borodino was neat. I wish it would have been a longer battle scene. Maybe the 4-hour version, the director's cut, it will be.
Yeah, that's something worth saying that I think a lot of people are talking about is this is about 2.5 hours. And they're talking about bringing out a streaming version that's 4 hours. But yeah. I'll come into why that might not necessarily be a positive from my perspective.
Right. And I love to stand on a soapbox and say, oh, I'm not going to see it, but I'll watch it. I know.
I'll watch it.
No, I thought cinematography was fine. What I really liked is my next category, which is costumes. I thought the Hussars looked like Hussars. I thought Napoleon's outfits were good. I thought Josephine looked like Josephine. What did you think of the costume?
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the strong points. I wasn't there to count buttons, as they say, you know, from a historical perspective. I wasn't looking that closely. I saw one review from a historian of clothing who was like, oh, you can tell that they've all been made by sewing machine rather than by hand.
Right.
I didn't get that level of detail. I thought they looked really good, especially Vanessa Kirby's is Josephine.
Yep.
That seemed very good. Obviously, you got the famous Napoleon uniforms, great coats, bicorn hat turned sideways. You see him turn it sideways. Those little bits, good. Certainly, the soldiers seem to be mostly dressed pretty well. There's a couple of like quite slouchy bags where they'd probably have them up a bit tight. But you can excuse all those kind of things. Yeah, I think costumes quite a strong point. There wasn't like some sort of glaring error that you spotted somebody walking around in trainers that they're famously in to be. And it added some rich color where you've got Malta and
The coronation setting. The coronation was like a artwork come alive. It was beautiful.
That was going to be one of my things for a positive, the coronation scene. Yeah. It was made out to be like the famous painting. You saw the sideways on, you saw the painter. We'll try to spoiler free, but it's hard. But it did. It looked very rich. It looked very vivid. That part was relatively exciting. I think the costumes there, but like you say, as soon as you go into battle, it's like this blue-gray brush they put over everything. You're like, oh, okay. Yeah. I'm not necessarily sure. And it's often happens that anything that's kind of set before the 1960s, you know, the flower power movement apparently brought colour to the world, literally. And I'm like, well, when you've got like Hussar in vivid blue with gold braid, he's going to be blingy, you know.
Right.
He's going to stand out.
Yeah, I agree with all that. Yeah, I thought they did a nice job, the costume department. So kudos to that group. The music, I was hoping for something like Gladiator, where it would be stuck in my brain, or Star Wars, or well, maybe not Star Wars, but some, you know what I mean? Like something that would stick with me. Now, I didn't think the music was very emotion evoking. I don't know about you.
No, exactly the same. Gladiator is my go-to there because it's Ridley Scott, because it's a historical epic.
Yep.
Everybody kind of, if you've seen Gladiator once, or definitely you've probably seen Gladiator 5 times, you can hum the theme tune. You might know, I think it's the Ennius ending, which he's, you know, kind of walking through the fields.
Yep.
It's an amazing tune. It builds, it's variations on a theme that they reuse at different times.
Yeah.
It's probably one of the big played ones that you get on like the top 100 list. It's great. I don't know about you. I've seen the film 2 days ago. Can't remember the music.
Yeah.
That'd be my test. Forgettable.
Yeah. And they played some like French songs kind of like around the Survivor's Ball and around like the opening with Marie Antoinette. So they played some like old French songs, which great. You know, you incorporate some of that, but I just don't remember any of the actual music being stirring, you know, like, oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
You don't have in your head a huge opera with hundreds of violinists and it's building and it's got the atmosphere and then you're waiting for a crescendo. That I don't remember there being that at all. Maybe I was focusing quite a lot on what was on screen, but I kind of, somebody said to me the other day, oh, the music was really forgettable. And I was kind of like, what music? You know, very background. Like, yeah. My mind does. If I don't remember it, it doesn't pass the old grey whistle test that we talk about. You couldn't hum the Napoleon theme tune, sadly.
Right.
And that is a huge part. Like, there's a lot of normal rock pop songs that I'll listen to. You mentioned Black Hawk Down.
Yeah.
I know that they fly in to a cover of Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
I like Jimi Hendrix, so I play that.
Yeah.
Voodoo Child.
Yeah.
You know, those songs in there,
yeah,
like, have an impact upon culture and things like that.
Yeah, like Apocalypse Now, Flight of the Valkyries, when the helicopters fly in. Like, it's
right.
It's like, wow, okay, that really stuck with me. Yeah.
A really good example. Yeah. People know Ride of the Valkyries more from Apocalypse Now than possibly if they're, you know, like me, than from classical music listening.
Right.
And one of the trailers for Napoleon had Black Sabbath, had War Pigs,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was a good song choice.
Right, you know? Right. Last thing on writing, and we're not up to my 10-minute mark yet, so we're not going to give too many spoilers away. David Scarper wrote the script. In fairness to him, it is very, very hard to write a 2.5-hour movie of a guy who lived 51 years and who was in power 15 of those years. So I understand how hard that must have been to write the script. But even the dialogue with Josephine and Napoleon, it seemed very strained. It didn't seem real. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't buy it.
Yes. Well, obviously I was taught, if I don't have anything polite to say, don't say anything at all. So the positives, I think I quite liked in some scenes, obviously spoiler free, in some scenes, Napoleon's away from Paris mm-hmm. and they read out, Phoenix has got a voiceover, reading out some of his letters to Josephine.
Mm-hmm.
I think that adds quite a lot to it. That was well done.
Yeah, indeed.
And that builds up an idea of correspondence and how it would have worked then and their troubled relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So the positives to me are the big one, the thing that gives it any star rating. It was a Napoleon and Josephine movie for me.
Mm-hmm.
If not Josephine and Napoleon, because I think Vanessa Kirby, this is my controversial angle, Vanessa Kirby was the better actress in this.
I think you might be right. Not that that's okay. A slight on Joaquin Phoenix. I think just she had better lines to work with, better dialogue.
She might have had better lines or she delivered it better. I don't know what it is. She was the star. And to me, she would be the one that I would be like, oh, she should be nominated for some of the big awards, mm-hmm. the Oscars and things like that. Phoenix, he felt very stiff.
Yeah.
His lines, there were bits that were, again, we're before spoilers, there were some bits that were almost comic.
Yeah.
Comically delivered, at least.
Yeah, yeah.
She was great, but some of their lines, it was a bit clunky. It was a bit... I've seen one theory online that it was almost a comedy to some people. If they watched it again, they'd be like, was Phoenix trying to make it comedic?
Yeah, or was Ridley Scott trying to slight the memory of Napoleon and say he wasn't anything big, you know, and this is my slam job on his reputation?
We'll come to that, let's say. I guess I can't do that without spoilers.
Right.
But you're right, there's elements there. The script wasn't strong.
No.
If I'm being nice.
No, it wasn't.
I can't write a movie script, so I'm not going to rip apart somebody's career. But it wasn't a strong element of the film.
I agree. Okay.
Maybe that's the edit, but
all right.
Maybe some of the casting saves some elements. Like I say, Vanessa Kirby, initially, everyone's like, oh, she's far too young to be Josephine. Actually, she carries it.
Yeah, she does. She makes it work. So kudos and credit to her.
Credit to her, yes. Some of the other ones, there were some quite good English actors and the reason I say that is because it was quite surprising to see some of the characters being like, oh, they were in something that I watched like 15 years ago. I haven't seen them in much recently. There's a British comedian called Miles Jupp who appears as the Emperor of the Austrians. And I was like, okay. That's unexpected.
Yeah, and I saw something online. The one French actor was Czar Alexander, the Russian. So, you know.
Yes.
Yeah,
there was some okay casting. There was some some quite small screen British actors that might not translate that were quite nicely surprising to see.
Right.
From my point of view, the negatives of that, this is mostly for John's benefit, is... I didn't feel that some of the marshals really stood out around Napoleon.
No, they did not. And we will jump into that now because we are at our 10-minute mark. All right.
Okay. Spoiler alert time, are we?
There we
okay.
go. All right.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, right.
We'll also put our little... Should we put our little caveats in as well?
Yeah. Spoiler alert. This is where I'll put the commercial.
And I'll say, you know, I hold anti-Bonapartist views. I think that's well publicized. Yeah,
and I'm a pro-Bonapartist, so this is...
He's pro-Bonapartist. Yeah. I'm not a academically trained historian, but nor I have guided on the battlefields. Yeah. I did manage the Duke of Wellington's house on very pro-Wellington.
And he has been to Waterloo many times. Are there trenches there, Marcus?
Should we start with Waterloo?
No, because I don't want you to get too angry. This is not... The okay. History Rage podcast. So shout out to them. I love their podcast.
Yes, thank you, Paul and Carl.
So let's start. It starts with the French Revolution, and they show the decapitation of Marie Antoinette. And I kind of, I understand why they put that in the movie. They want to grab your attention, and they want to show how chaotic of a time it was in France. Did you think that needed to be in there?
So, don't know if it needed to be in. I liked the beginning of the film. Okay. I genuinely did. I went in, maybe because I was going in with an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
I was going in, I wanted entertainment more than history.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted, like I said, I wanted a gladiator. I wanted to, like Russell Crowe says, are you not entertained? Mm-hmm. I wanted that. And seeing, it didn't need, in many ways, it didn't need to be Marie Antoinette. It
right.
could have been a aristocrat.
Yeah, you know, it could have been Josephine's husband. I think that would have been more interesting. Like
that would have been more interesting.
Yeah.
And Napoleon was certainly in Paris at certain times during the revolution. I think he was mostly outside the city during the terror. Mm-hmm. We know about the whiff of grape shots part later. But yeah, I think it captured the attention. The guillotine is very evocative as a... You know, a way of execution. It starts with a nice. It was probably it had some jolly kind of French music in the background, and
right.
it was probably a good way to draw it in with a big crowd, lots of people cheering, people bloodlusting for an execution is always something that I find quite interesting when I talk about the fate of people in London.
Yeah,
when I used to give tours. And I compare it to when you see a car crash by the side of the road, what do most people do? They slow down to watch it.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
If we had gladiatorial games or a guillotine today, would people go and see it? I think it would surprise you.
Yeah.
So I think it was a good opening scene. I think the French Revolution was really important for context. And though Napoleon wasn't at Marie Antoinette, it's one of those ones that you're like, well, he's not like he was pulling the rope to execute her and he was a bystander. So it's kind of one of those ones that you're like, you can let that go. It's entertaining.
Yep. And from there, just so we don't rehash every blow by blow, but they kind of introduced us to Paul Barras, and I thought that actor did a really good job. The guy who played Barras.
Yeah, he steers a lot of the first half of the film.
Yep.
He kind of you see where it takes Napoleon's career, and him and Lucien Bonaparte. There's a nice little kind of like. Three-way friendship going on there, and it makes sense about some of the early actions and his career. So again, probably quite good casting. The hair certainly seemed quite recognizable. So yep. good stuff okay. so far
so good. And we move now, and Bra says, hey, we can't lose too long because if the British take over and the royalists take over, that'll ruin the revolution. So Napoleon's dispatched down there as basically the artillery commander, but not the overall commander. And I did like the part where he gets there and he's pulling artillery from around France, because that's true. They didn't have enough to take these forts around the harbor. So I did like that. And that was really the only bit of strategy. And this is one of my gripes with the movie. Napoleon's supposed to be a strategic genius. I wish they would have showed somehow like his mind, how it worked and how he saw a battlefield, like, almost like A Beautiful Mind, like that, like when Russell Crowe's doing, like, that would have been neat to me.
A Beautiful Mind, or in the Sherlock film, he has his TV series, he has the Mind Palace, and he's like pulling out bits of information.
Yeah.
Something like that, like, or maybe his mind, he shows maps, because he's got
right.
topography.
Right.
But yeah, you see him like organizing artillery and being a bit dynamic, and that doesn't happen in any of the other battles.
Yeah,
he just kind of orders the artillery to open fire. In fact, at the Battle of the Pyramids, you only have the first shot of the cannon, and then that's it. Done.
Yeah. Again, why is that scene in there? Yeah, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that. And they show him, and you mentioned this before, he's kind of dressed as a commoner spying on the garrison at Toulon. And, you know, he did spy on enemy formations as he did at Bagram with Massena. We don't know about Toulon, right?
I know he's meant to have crawled on one of his eastern fronts. He's meant to have crawled forwards and almost be captured. I don't believe it happened at Toulon. It didn't add much. It didn't detract much. It was like, okay. I think my big thing with Toulon is that they could have added something really simple and it would have added a lot to it, which was him being wounded, which happened in the thigh by a British sergeant. Yep. And it wasn't like, oh, it's not in the edit, because you see him the next day and he's not limping.
Yeah.
We're on full spoilers now. So there's a scene where his horse is killed under him.
Yeah, very gory.
Really gory, because it's like the third scene of the film. And it's like,
Right. I'm like, okay, well, they got my attention again. If they want gore, you know,
that's probably the most I sat up and like, I'm paying attention now. If you're a horse lover, you know, it's not nice.
This is not the movie for you if you're a horse lover.
Yeah. And then there was a bit where they're meant to be loaded. You see them talk about loading heated shots to burn the British fleet, which doesn't really happen. And I love the fact they're loading the heated shot, which isn't glowing. So heated shot, basically cannonballs that are non-explosive that are on fires, and they get them really hot and then load them in so that they'll burn wood and things.
Yeah.
And you don't see them loading them up. You do see the ships burning, and then you see them loading them by hand. You're like, ooh, they would have nice, the smell of raw flesh coming off their hands there.
Second degree burns, right?
Yeah. Ooh.
There is a cool scene that I did like. They show him right before the Toulon attack, and he's nervous. He's just kind of jittery because this is like his first real command attack. And I like that they showed that he was nervous in that battle and he was more calm in the other ones.
It is good to kind of humanize these people a bit.
Yeah.
Not just to take Napoleon down a peg or two, but he was a man, not a demigod. And so he would have gone through, you know, some genuine real emotions.
Yeah. And, you know, he was promoted to Brigadier General. So that part was good after Toulon. I think that might have happened before Toulon, though, or somewhere.
Yeah, I think it was before the attack. But the opening parts, overall, I think the film starts okay. Like,
It's
just above mediocre. It's like, okay, this could be an all right film.
Yeah. So far, no problems. Major. They briefly touch on Robespierre back in Paris. They show him shooting himself in the head, which again shows the general chaos of the French government. But it's very hard if you're not a Napoleon or Napoleonic age follower, you know, like, which government is this? Who's in charge now? It's very hard to figure. And maybe that's what they were trying to convey, that it was chaotic, but there's the directory. There's the the Committee on Public Safety. There's the three councils. So it's kind of hard to figure out who's in charge when you're watching the movie.
And they don't really explain who Robespierre is. He's effectively the kind of dictator of France at that point. It looks a little bit more like a modern parliament, Senate maybe in America, or the House of Commons here with a speaker, and you're like, well, actually that's not really how it's being run. And it does become quite political and social. I would have been quite happy if they'd left the battle scenes after Toulon. Like, we got that one, he's a general, let's do the politics. But now we don't. Though we do get introduced about this time to Josephine at the survivors ball you mentioned earlier. And there's a nicely set, there's big lavish affairs and parties and costumes and music. We're used to Vanessa Kirby. Again, she's younger. Something that's a little bit uncomfortable to watch, maybe if you're with your family, is that they show her that she's sexually experienced and he's not. So yeah. I don't know how you unwrap that one, watching that with your children.
Right, yeah. Yeah, this is definitely an R-rated movie. But I did like that they showed him being awkward at parties and social gatherings. Like, he's almost like a wallflower. Like, he doesn't know how to interact with anybody.
Yeah.
So yeah. I did like that.
I think it's even in Andrew Roberts' biography that he famously goes out in Paris with his money and fails to get laid in Paris trying to hire a prostitute. He just kind of is quite awkward as a young man. So, yeah. There's elements that tie together at the beginning. And the more that we get of that early relationship with Josephine, I think the better. The movie really now could have been more of a personal and social history and moved away from the military.
Yeah.
Because it gets worse.
Yeah, it does. And they show a brief courtship with Josephine and Napoleon, which is fine. They don't have a lot of time to dedicate to it. So that's fine. You can fast forward through that. There's a small wedding. And then I thought it was kind of cute. Or maybe it's spot on. You know, Napoleon's trying to kiss her during the ceremony, and she's kind of pulling away, Like, I don't think she loved him at this point. She was just looking for safety and security.
Right. And she'd almost been executed.
Right.
Her husband had been executed. She needed somebody, and he's a general now. So
right. Right. And as soon as he's in Egypt, she's with Hippolyte Charles, the Hussarga, that cavalryman.
Yeah. And you see that, you see her affairs, and then fast forward halfway through the film, he confronts her and she says, well, you've had affairs. And they kind of have to have a bit of an argument about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And speaking of fast forward, I hope this is in the 4-hour version, but Italy's nowhere in there. And that's where he makes his name. That's where Napoleon becomes Napoleon.
Italy's not mentioned at all.
They do show the revolt in Paris in 1795 briefly.
Yeah.
You know, Barras says, hey, I need you. Can you put this revolt down? And he's like, yes, but if I have total control, which was accurate. And yes, he did blow people's heads off with cannons. I wish they could have snuck Murat in there and have him going to Sablon to get the cannons, but they didn't. I wish they would have.
No Murat there. I always find it interesting because it's about the second or third time that Paris looks suspiciously like Greenwich Old Naval College in London. And that gets used a lot for filming. It's a beautiful location. They use it in Pole Dark. I think they even use it in one of the Thor Marvel films.
Right.
But they use the same bit, which is the central like courtyard of the Old Naval College, twice to be Paris. And I'm not sure it's meant to be the same bit of Paris. And you're like, okay, yeah, it's really nice.
Right.
But one of the few kind of military scenes that they do well, they show the effects of grape shot on the French civilians quite well.
Yeah, that's what it would have looked like.
Like, not everyone dies, but there's like a lady dragging herself away with two legs missing.
Oh, right. That's grabbing your attention. You're like, good God. You know, this is a brutal time to be alive right there.
Yeah. There's the whiff of grape shot moment. I don't think he actually gets the quote in. I was waiting for the that quote to come through.
Yeah, but even that scene, they could have done more strategy, because I remember reading about it, and like Napoleon had the cannon sighted, so when the crowd fell back, they'd fall back into more cannons and then more muskets, and then the cavalry would charge. And there wasn't any of that. It was just one cannon.
One cannon, like, volley, that's it.
Yeah, and you love cannons.
I like cannons. Yeah, I was gonna say it's not even a volley; it's a salvo. I'm picking myself up it. It's just one load, and he kind of does this thing that you see in, I think, about three shots, where he puts his hands over both ears, his elbows out. I don't know. There was definitely a thing that Ridley Scott's trying to do on purpose there, to show a repetition of the battles with this view. Him suddenly Phoenix really straight on, hat on sideways, hands over his ears, cannons fire. You see it in Egypt, you see it in Waterloo. I'm not sure if you see it in Austerlitz.
I wonder if, I mean, Napoleon was in, God, how many battles? I doubt he covered his ears every time artillery went off.
No. You know? And he's like right in the middle of the cannons every time, which normally you want to stand back a little bit, because shock waves and sound goes forwards.
Although, give Ridley Scott credit, the cannons did recoil in this movie.
True.
Think about it.
Yeah. There's a lot of films where they don't, where they just put like a firework down the barrel. Yeah.
Right. So give him a point on that. 1 point there. From there they go to Egypt. Like I said, they skip over Italy entirely. For whatever reason, General Junot has more lines than Marshal Ney or Davout.
Yeah.
But he's there, and he tells Napoleon that Josephine is cheating on him. And at first, Napoleon can't believe it. And then Junot says, no, I'm being serious. And they hop on a boat, and he's like, I have to get back to France. And it's fine if you want to make it the love story, but that's not why he went back to France.
No. He's going back for very different reasons. We get very little in Egypt. We get like the Battle of the Pyramids, famously, I think it's in the trailer as well. He fires a cannon, one shot, hits the top of the pyramids. Well, the Battle of the Pyramids didn't actually take place at the bottom of the pyramids.
Correct.
And there's not a lot to like there.
No.
They do a long scene with the mummy, a short scene with the battle, neither of which seem to be done brilliantly. You were saying before we came on that there was
I did like
some imagery about the mummy. Did you want to
explain? I did, and here's why. I think he was kind of like looking into a mirror in a way with I assume he's like a pharaoh or a very important person. They find like a mummy in a tomb, and I said, I think Ridley put that in there because one, life is short, and two, glory is fleeting. And Napoleon's kind of looking at this mummy, and as he tries to touch him, the mummy kind of like falls to the side.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, is he saying that Napoleon wants to be a all powerful pharaoh and he's never going to be one? Or I thought that scene was interesting, and I wish they would have stuck with that a little bit longer.
Yeah, and I couldn't tell if the mummy falling to the side was meant to be funny or if it's meant to be like symbolic of he doesn't quite touch that power. He puts his hat on the sarcophagus, which makes him look like the mummy's Napoleon. He stands on a box, which I was like, oh, is that a nod to him being short? Which obviously he was average height. So yeah, and then he's back. He's back to confront Josephine, but then all of a sudden we actually come on to what I thought was probably, apart from the coronation, the best scene, the coup de Brumet.
Oh yeah, the coup was great. But by the way, you Admiral Nelson lovers, there is no Battle of the Nile
Or Trafalgar. Yeah. £200 million budget, very few boats.
Yeah. But yeah, the coup was very well done, I thought.
You see him bungle it and his brother save it.
Right. And I love that scene where Lucien was like holding the sword against his chest. And he says, you know, I forget what the line is, but I'll run the sword through my brother. If I ever think he'll become a tyrant. And then Lucien kind of makes his face is like, well, let's see what they think about that.
That actually was genuinely funny. I don't think that was quite well delivered, but that was more, I don't remember his name, the actor who played Lucien Bonaparte. And they kind of, he does a, oh, I don't really mean it, but. Let's see what the lads think, and they all turn around with their mustaches and bearskin hats and charge in.
Yeah, that part was great. I like that part. Yeah.
And I think that was quite good. And I think that's when we start to see what Ridley Scott's interpretation of Bonaparte is a bit more, which is a man who's pushing power rather than a man of destiny.
Right.
And that's actually something I could relate to. You know, I don't like Napoleon. I think he was pushing power. I think he was a tyrant.
Right.
We've covered that before. But
right.
I can reflect there what he was trying to do. This doesn't seem inaccurate to go, well, this was a military coup. He went in there, he didn't do it very well, and then he forced the bayonet point, the end of like a very bad working democracy, but he forced the end of that. And that was quite nicely done. You saw the costumes were really good in that scene because the directory all had these weird like Roman togas and they were showing that.
And then they also show, which was true, when Napoleon got back home, you know, Josephine's crying at his door and he finally relents and says, you know, and they kind of show their dynamic, which maybe that's what Ridley Scott was trying to show, is her dominance over him, but he dominated everything else. Maybe that was like the juxtaposition he was trying to convey to the audience. Like, here's this great man who controlled Europe, but he couldn't. His wife dominated him. I don't know what the dynamic was.
Well, let's dive into that because it would be so easy. We could do every like scene of this film. I think Josephine and Vanessa Kirby really was the highlight. She had we talked about the script. I think she acted it better, but I think it's quite an engaging story. I think it's something that could be delivered on the big screen without like the need for huge budget and special effects. And we've got, you know, some of the written evidence of the letters between them, so it can be relatively accurate. Mm-hmm. And it's quite engaging. It's two people falling in love for different reasons and then having some really difficult times, falling out of love, but possibly, you know, falling back in. And it was quite well. They showed the ups and downs of the relationship, the near divorce, falling back into love, so the marriage. And
he's pestering her about having an heir over dinner. You know?
Right, yeah, and he's like, they get down to it under the dinner table, and then he's talking about fertility over a drinks party with everyone there, and those kind of things. You're like, oh, it's a little bit awkward, but then you also, like we said earlier, you feel his awkwardness there. There's a scene where he kind of tries to make, I think, like animal noises in the bedroom with her servants around.
That was weird too.
That was weird. There's quite a few like awkward sex scenes. I did say to someone, I was like, they were like, oh, I'm gonna go see this with my son. I was like, oh, okay, it's gonna be really awkward.
yeah
but I thought it was good. And I personally, if they cut back, and I'm a man who likes my military films, you know, I'm very stereotypical, yada yada, if they cut out the battle scenes and done a Josephine and Napoleon, I would have thought I probably would have ended up with a better film. Those scenes were stronger.
I think that's one of my problems with it. And the movie doesn't seem like it knows where it wants to go. Do we focus on Napoleon and Josephine? Do we focus on the battles? Do we focus on the diplomacy with Talleyrand? Or do we focus on, you know, the overall scheme of things? Yeah. I read a review, and I don't know the critic or Twitter handle who wrote it, and I thought it was brilliant. It's like going on a bus tour of Napoleon's life, but they don't let you off the bus to look at anything too closely. Like, you're zooming through his life on a bus tour, but you're not allowed to get off the bus.
Yeah, I've seen those. I've seen basketball tour guys who do that. Mentioning no companies. Yeah. Yeah, that kind of is, because you build up. There's like a long scene, say it's like 4 or 5 minutes, which is relatively long, of two people sat on a sofa, quite intimate. Mm. And they discuss that. And then the next scene is Napoleon riding on a campaign.
Yeah.
The good bit is the voiceover of him reading his letters to her.
Yeah.
But then you're kind of moving between that intimate to the grand scale. And yeah, like I say, it doesn't quite know what it wants to be. I think they would have almost been better to kind of had him riding on campaign, skip the battle, have him coming back. Or just have like, just the battle in his mind's eye rather than actually let's do an eagle eye view of Borodino, because Napoleon didn't see Borodino from the air, from a helicopter, from a drone. You know, the most he could see was from his horse on a hill. So why are we getting these shots?
Well, since you brought it up, let's talk about the first major, well, I guess the second major battle would be Austerlitz.
Yeah, this is a big one.
All right. Let's pretend we know nothing. All right, it's a very cool scene. The ice breaking is very dramatic. The czar and the king, emperor of Austria, talking beforehand. They think it's going to be a pushover. Napoleon's going to get destroyed, which was accurate. They're very overconfident.
Yeah.
So as an outsider looking and knowing nothing about it, you might say, "Oh, well, that was interesting." And there's talk of high ground, and there's a little bit of strategy. But you and I know. I don't know why they showed them attacking their tents and their camp. I don't know why that was in there.
No. And I think if I was trying to park any knowledge of the battle, I would say, oh, okay, why did the Austrian Russian army march across the frozen river? You know, surely they'd be going, oh, this area is marked on a map as a river, our scouts have gone out. You see their scouts. That's in the scene right before the battle. They see a load of Cossacks scouting. Yep. We go, actually, we won't march across the frozen river. And then it turns out the whole battlefield, apart from where the French stood, is a frozen river.
Right.
And they drown everyone in one big go.
Yeah, with cannon shots. And
my understanding of it is that was like the edge, the southern edge of the battle happened. It happened like less than a battalion. And Napoleon genuinely did write it as a great thing that happened. And tried to, you know, he's big on propaganda. But to this scale, it looks like... I'm trying to liken it to Gladiator again. It looked like the whole army had just got marched into one big trap, and that was Austerlitz. And if you went out of the battle, you'd be like, oh, those Russians and Austrians, because they were just really stupid, weren't they?
And if you read the account of the full battle, that's almost like a footnote. Like, I think it would have been more interesting if they showed the camp before with the Russians and Austrians and Kutuzov saying, no, this is a trap, and then him like falling asleep because he doesn't want to hear it anymore. And then if they would have shown the rush who went into Napoleon's camp and Napoleon acted timid and meek, so the guy would think he was a weak man. I think if they would have shown more of that and the Protestant Heights and his army moving off the Protestant Heights. And,
yes.
You know, the son of Austerlitz and the mist, like you said in your post, like, where is all that? Why not put that in the movie? That's more dramatic than a frozen pond.
It would be really hard to capture. You know, Austerlitz was quite a dynamic battle. There was lots of movement.
True.
So show one bit through Napoleon's eyes, or show one bit through a single soldier's, you know, over his musket or something.
Right. But
this bit that didn't happen, I was like, that's not the whole battle. I think to me, my question back to you is it entertaining?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, I don't know. It felt like, because the army goes in, they then go, oh, we're on ice, and they run away and they're all killed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that's entertaining. We see it. There's the, I'm not sure who the director was, but there's the Keira Knightley King Arthur movie with Ewan Griffith as Lancelot.
Oh, yeah.
And that has a whole battle where they just go on ice and they march forward and one of the guys runs out and he smashes all the ice to pieces and all the Saxons, I think it is, fall through the ice. And that's the whole battle. Very similar to that.
Maybe that's the look. And it is. I mean, it's shot beautifully. The people, the horses and the cannonballs going through the ice.
The camera switches under the ice, a bit like opening to Saving Private Ryan. The camera's under there. The cannonballs are coming towards you.
Yep.
I was like, it's kind of entertaining. I'm not sure it's anything new. If you mix Saving Private Ryan with the old King Arthur movie, from the early 2000s, somewhere in there. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. But that's not...
It started to feel like we're taking a downturn. We tried to do something really big here, and the flavor's off the mark.
Yeah. And this isn't even the worst battle of the movie, so we'll get to that here in a minute. So we'll just say it was the second worst battle of the movie. It's fine. I mean, maybe Bordino, because it's briefly shown.
Very briefly shown.
Yeah.
Let's skip a bit. We go into Russia.
Well, yeah. Well, we missed the coronation. I'm going to go over that real quick.
Oh, sorry, we did miss the coronation. Sorry. Yep.
So I love this scene. And it's good. I've never seen, I don't know. I can't recall a movie where I saw a piece of artwork come alive like I did in that scene. Like, that was, it has spot on, nailed it. Other than Hippolyte Charles being there, I'm 99% sure Napoleon wouldn't have had that guy there. But everything else was beautiful, don't you think?
Yeah, it was really stunning. That's the colors. There was a bit of a soundtrack underneath it, thankfully. You actually see the official painter, a chap called David, surname. He's there, and you see him painting that scene and the crown going up onto his laurel wreath. Yeah, stunning. Again, the costumes, the fur trims, the gold.
That occurred in Notre Dame, which obviously is not available right now. It's being refurbished. Did they film that in the UK?
Yeah, I think they filmed it in York. Could be wrong, but it's certainly an English cathedral, Minster up north, and it works from that point of view. It's a big, stunning vaulted cathedral, looks really good as a visual. This up there as one of those scenes, it's very different to where the Scots Greys, the Royal North British Dragoons, come alive at the Waterloo Epic 1970, mm-hmm. and that's they put that in there on purpose. This was a nice homage. Almost you wonder, like, oh, if he'd done the Crossing the Alps, obviously he did on the Mule, there's that painting. If they'd done lots of those, that might have been a good, better film.
Right. Yeah.
That was good. I like that.
Stick to the artwork and just have that come alive. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, yeah, if we take that and then we let's skip to actually coming out of Moscow. You were saying earlier that visually looked really good.
I love that, where he comes out of, he's in his bedroom and he wakes up and Moscow is burning, and you see it's a shot of him from behind with his hat on. And it's almost like, instead of Moscow burning, it's foreshadowing of his empire burning and just ending. I thought that was brilliant. I like that a lot. Yeah,
the colors with it being nighttime and the oranges and everyone looking very confused. Yeah, I think the implication there that so much has gone wrong.
Yeah, but we're jumping ahead a little bit. Let me get back to our timeline. There is, they introduce Napoleon's mom, Madame Marais, Leticia, and they don't have any Napoleon sisters, thank goodness, but they have
none.
And she is kind of introduced as like, I don't like this Josephine, I think you could have a baby, here's this woman I have for you in the bedroom. And that part was kind of like crammed in there. It was just odd.
It was crammed in, it was odd, but again, it was one of the stronger parts of the kind of the story is that it pushing his relationship with Josephine apart.
Right.
And I like that side of it. I went there expecting a war film, and I like the personal elements more.
Yeah.
I know I'm repeating myself, but that's how I felt.
No, you're right. Because the just made me angry that they were so wrong. So you're right. Yeah.
And there's not all of the family. Lucien's the main one that they show. There's none of the sisters, which maybe they're in small scenes in the big epic, you know, 4-hour cut. But
and Hortense, Eugene are in there briefly, but that's about it.
Eugene's there, yeah.
That moves on. He does get this mistress pregnant, so they get divorced, and there's that seems strange too, because obviously Josephine is crying, and she cried in real life, but there's like a
thing. It's a slap, yeah.
Yeah, where Napoleon's like, you know, yelling at her to sign this thing, and I'm, again, 99% sure that didn't happen. I wasn't there. I don't know. So I was just an odd.
Ridley Scott says we weren't there, so we don't know.
Yep, exactly. So they do. They get divorced, and then Napoleon has a new wife, Marie Louise, who's barely in the movie for two.
She seconds. Arrives in one scene, like
yeah.
In fact, I think you see her arrive, and then you see the baby.
Yeah, and then
we definitely skip 9 months. Like
yeah, yeah. And then he brings the baby to Josephine to show it off, which, you know, I'm sure it did happen, but it was just...
I think that happened. Yeah, I think I was reading that happened.
Yeah, I'm sure it did, but it was just an odd scene. Like, why is that in the movie? You know,
Again, maybe it's because they were building on the Napoleon-Josephine relationship, and they showed another scene where they were divorced, and he was like, you're going to keep writing to me. You're going to keep writing to me. And she was like, mm-hmm. I was like, yeah. Oh, you didn't get like a vocal confirmation there.
And they did stay friends. That part is true, even though they got divorced. Like, Napoleon still took care of her, gave her Malmaison, gave her money. So that part was accurate. They remained close.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that relationship. It's the better part of the film. But second wife, once, I mean, lots of Bonapartists, they never talk about her. They just talk about Josephine. And we get one scene and she's a pretty looking, meek young girl. And the character's not fleshed out any more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, and they showed Tilsit briefly, or Napoleon and Alexander are flattering each other, but even that is like glossed over really quickly.
I think that's too complicated to get into 2-3 minutes, so use it or lose it. And did it really add much to it? Not really.
Yeah. So jumping ahead, as we do, to the invasion of Russia, they show the hit and run tactics of the Cossacks. You know, I know mortars probably don't look like that, but it was
sled mortars. I was like, couldn't say they definitely didn't use them, but I was like, famously cavalrymen, like show them as cavalrymen or yeah.
Yeah.
But you get the idea of hit and run tactics, like you say, you know that the Cossacks or
and they show, like French soldiers nailed to trees. It was a brutal.
Right. You start to get the brutality in.
Right.
I think there was one or two shots where you see it like marching on a road and you started to feel like the front of the end of the column. And I was like, okay, they have decided not to use loads of CGI here. That's nearly always a bonus for me, but the scale started to feel quite small. I was like, this looks like it's a brigade of men rather than the Grand Army of 1812.
Right, right.
So I started to lose the slight belief of this is a massive epic film again.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just me, but.
Yeah, no.
I was also starting to lose interest. The pace here, we've gone from, I think we started in 1792 and we're up to 1812. I was like, oh, we've covered a lot of ground. And
this
took the last hour and a half.
Yeah, and they did have one bit that I liked where Napoleon's handing out bread to his troops. And I wish they would have shown, again, you know, time limitations. His troops worshipped him and loved him.
Yeah, true.
And I saw he did tug on like one kid's ear throughout the movie.
He did his ear tug, your famous ear tug. He pulled on their earlobes.
But I wish it was still shown his interaction with the common soldiers because, you know, they would have run through a wall for this man. And I think that they didn't show, in addition to the strategy, they didn't show any of his strategy. They didn't show his dynamics with like the general soldier at all.
Again, we've spent so much time on Josephine, politics, international relations. We're now missing out on this. Is it a war film? Is it a personal, or is it a little bit of nothing?
Yeah.
Where it's trying to be so much, you know, we're now seeing the campaign rather than the battle. We're kind of then missing out the battle because we're seeing soldiers march, you know, what we're trying to do here. And I think by the time we got to Russia, my attention span certainly was lacking. I was like,
Yeah.
I know what's coming next. It's retreat from Moscow. Come on.
You're right. Yeah, mine was kind of lagging too. I was excited to see what Waterloo was going to look like. I was like, all right.
Yeah. His Borodino was like brief.
Yeah, I didn't know. Like, why bother?
Exactly. I mean, it must have been a big like day shoot with loads of extras lined up and drilled. And
yeah, maybe in the 4-hour version, there's more to it. And then he gets to Moscow and there's this weird scene where he's like, come out, little boy. I'm looking for you. And he's on the throne and there's like birds crapping on it.
Yeah. It felt like, I can't remember the series exactly, but it definitely felt like Game of Thrones.
It did,
The big throne room, sitting on the sword of the throne of swords, and then they're actually not being the battle. I was like, oh, I think we've seen this recently in fantasy. Again, you're kind of like, okay, you're sat on the throne, the camera lingers, now what?
Yep.
Yeah. All I can say to people, if you haven't seen it, the pace is really strange in this film. It's like an old video cassette.
Yeah.
It's almost like pressing fast forward and then pressing slow-mo.
Yeah, you're right. It is. And pacing is off. And then speaking of breakneck speed, next thing you know, he's abdicating his throne.
Yeah, we go, and I think it even like voiceovers historically correctly, to, it goes, oh, well, he's retreating. It's thinking it was December 1812. He abdicates and goes to Elba. And you're like, yeah. Oh, okay, I get why you haven't done the 1813, 1814 campaign. Right. I get why you haven't done Leipzig, because it's a massive, complicated battle. But you haven't mentioned it. You haven't shown it. You haven't summarized it.
Right. And
it's weird. The decision-making of what is and isn't included is a right. very strange one.
And you start off the movie with, you know, some brutal scenes, you know, Marie Antoinette and that horse getting killed, and, you know, Toulon. And then you have the opportunity to show how horrific the retreat was, and it was. Or show the bridging of the Berezina and all the men who died in that river.
I thought we were going to see Berezina.
Yeah.
And I thought, actually, I think other people's theories that Ridley Scott's being anti-Napoleon, I thought we were going to see him retreating in a sleigh. We just kind of see them plodding backwards through the snow for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, yeah. So
again, I'm like, my attention's not being captured.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. And then he's signing the abdication document, and then he's off to Elba, and then from that point, it just kind of goes off the rails. Josephine is somewhat seducing Alexander, which may or may not have been true. I don't think it was. She was just having him over in Paris after Alexander conquered Paris with the Allies. And in the regular timeline, she dies right there. She, you know, he's Napoleon's in Elba and she dies. But in this movie, they do something different, don't they?
Yeah, we get a long lingering death. We get old Bonaparte's coming, and it's quite a long scene. And then
And there's Bonaparte like a
arriving to see her.
Yeah, there's like a tabloid that he reads that the Tsar is with Josephine at his old house. You know,
having a dance.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just strange. We get these fast bits, slow bits, personal bits.
And now they did show the great scene with the 5th Regiment where he takes off his overcoat and says, you know, will you shoot your emperor? I did like that they put that in the movie.
Yeah. I like they did it. It seemed quite historically accurate. I did see somebody put on social media, oh, if I was with the 5th Regiment and it was Jaquin Phoenix's Napoleon, I probably would have shot it. but it was because it was very different to Rod Steiger in the. I love the 1970 film. I right. really do. It's one right. of my favorites. Right. And when Rod Steiger's like, here I am, here's your emperor, like, oh, that, you can hear a pin drop, can't you? It's like, right. oh, amazing. All there's also a lot more people. There also seems to be the 5th Regiment. It seems about 20 guys, which is what they do in Sharp. I know. Right. It's one of my favorites. But it's like, oh, where's everyone else? And then right. they kind of like half-heartedly cheer and go forwards. And you're like, okay, this is where we're definitely in an English park. And it's a nice little scene.
Right. But, and then he gets the Malmaison, and Hortense is like, oh, no, she died too late.
Oh, she died. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, she died.
Yeah. Oh, she died. You're like, oh, you're too late. It wasn't, it didn't add a lot. They kind of look at each other for a while.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, are we doing the 1815 100 Days campaign, or are we doing that?
Okay. So now.
Okay. So now.
We're going to do Waterloo, but I wanted you to take a deep breath. Okay.
All right. I'm so angry.
Okay. Now, the one thing that they did get right was the rain. All right. That part.
Well, do they?
Do they? Right.
Because they get it raining like all morning until 11 o'clock. And what really happened is it rained the day before very heavily and then a little bit in the morning. And what they're really waiting for is it to dry out. And what we get in the film is it's raining until the cannon's fire. And he fires as soon as this rain stops. So, sorry, but even that, no.
Yeah.
I am going to get angry. But I do not recognize Waterloo in those scenes. Waterloo is, on its simplest level, the battlefield, the main battlefield itself is two ridges with three farmhouses and a very important strategy of the Prussians arriving from the east.
Mm-hmm.
We get two ridges, both of which are covered in tents.
Yep.
There wasn't a tent city. Neither of them worked from a tent.
Loads
of flags. Everyone's commented like this obsession with the flags. You can visit both Napoleon and Wellington's headquarters. They're now both museums. So they didn't work from tents. Wellington here famously from the saddle all day. He's not on a horse.
Yeah, that was something that bothered me too.
That's weird.
Both commanders were very static. I mean, they do show Napoleon later in a cavalry charge, but they're both kind of like, yes, that will do. Yes, go now, Marshal Ney. Like, it just seemed very boring
very, very flat. You don't get any sort of dynamic from Wellington or Napoleon.
Wellington was running from square to square. He almost lost this battle. Like, there's none of that.
Yeah, he almost gets captured. He almost gets killed in the squares. And instead of farmhouses, what we've got now is it's been really lampooned is a series of trenches.
And there's no trenches anywhere there. Yeah.
I cannot stress this enough to anyone who, hopefully, if you're listening to this, you've got a base knowledge, but there are not trenches dug. I think there might have been over on the east flank some protection on some of the Allied guns, but we didn't really get those kind of fascines and things built up around the guns, which could have happened. They had a night in. What they did do was fortify Le Hougoumont a little bit, with like a firing step and some holes in the wall. That's about the extent of it.
Days and days to prepare this battlefield.
No, they had one evening, and they do a little bit on the farmhouses. Now the farmhouses aren't there. You get these big drone shots, so it's very clear that the farmhouses aren't there, and the trenches are, and all the armies clustered in. From a British perspective, and I say British because that you do not see any allies.
Nope. Well, Prussians coming from the west.
So yeah, you get the Prussians coming from the wrong side, from the west. They've hooped the whole way around the town and come in. You had a big mix in the Anglo-Allied army of different uniforms of Nassau, Dutch, Belgian, German, Hanoverian, but you don't get. You just get redcoats. There's a couple of artillery and some 95th rifles.
Can we
talk about that?
Right. When did the Marcus Cribb groan raising of arms occur? Was that the sharpshooter moment? When did that?
I had the trenches. I was groaning.
Okay.
So the big one was obviously everyone knows that you start a battle by massive cavalry charge against trenches, right?
Of course.
One of the big military minds, I'm not going to say great, one of the big military minds of the era.
Yeah.
So the French start the battle by launching a cavalry charge. In real life, it was attacks against Hougoumont and d'Erlon's corps marching up, infantry, and a counter charge by British cavalry. So we just end up with a cavalry charge. And the best thing, if you had trenches with spikes out the front, you'd go, okay, I can use this against cavalry. And the British get out of the trenches, march forwards, not backwards, forwards onto the forward slope, into the valley, and form square. Well, actually, in real life, they form square on the reverse. But it was like trying to go, okay, from a historical point of view, it's just rubbish now. From a... if I don't know anything about the Battle of Waterloo, but I've played Napoleon Total War, why have I left my defences? Why have I marched towards the cavalry? You know, this is like a really basic military level. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I just worked all night on these trenches that didn't exist.
Yeah. So, I'll use those trenches. That'd be really useful. Thank you.
Yeah.
I've just dug this. So I think that was the moment, and they formed square then. And about that time, British countercharge with their cavalry, which is a bit strange. Then the Prussians come in from the wrong side, and they think they show a map early of the Prussians to the east, so they kind of line themselves up for that failure.
Did you like the visual of the squares forming? I thought that looked kind of cool.
But the armies march forward. This is where I'll be a bit more of a nerd. The armies march forward in three ranks, and the British worked in two ranks deep. So I was like, you got it wrong. They form squares quite neatly. You could tell that the extras have been drilled there. That was a bit slick. I'll give it to them. But there's so much negative. It's not okay. We can't shine that a dog do, as they say.
No. We cannot polish that.
And everybody's in a melee at this point. You've got, it's almost again like the opening to Gladiator, but without the good music. That just everybody gets involved. Like you say, Napoleon gets on his horse, jumps into the middle, and he's hacking and slashing at redcoats.
Right.
In real life, he had hemorrhoids. He's got a really sore bum. He's not on his horse in a cavalry charge.
He does. And Marshal Ney is barely involved. He's just carrying out orders. And let's talk about the Baker rifle real quick.
Yeah, let's.
Now, I wasn't there. You weren't there. So we don't know.
Yeah, 100%. Wasn't there.
But I don't. Can you slap a telescope on a Baker rifle and say, "Oh, I'm gonna shoot the Emperor"? And I don't know.
Even in sharp, they don't do this. So what they've got is somebody's got a telescope and he's strapped it onto a Baker rifle, an infantry pattern rifle. It's from the 95th Rifles, and he's strapped it on and with rags, and then he's holding it on like a walking stick, a V-shaped walking stick, which is not a very, very stable way to have a rifle. You know, you'd lie down or put it on a log or sandbag or something like that. I mean, he's in a he could be in a trench, so he could lie on the edge of the trench. It would be more stable. Getting nerdy about marksmanship principles here. Anyone who's done armed forces, any description, we know what I'm talking about.
Right.
And you do your breathing and you do your position. Anyway. And what you're lacking on a telescope is any form of markings, crosshairs, we call them. Yeah, right. So what you've got is a rifle and a zoom on it, which if you haven't aligned it, is just going to go forwards.
Right.
So you're not aiming at anything. And you couldn't like put this in and scratch it in yourself. Like it just, that's not how it works. And I said it before we come on, can I talk about rear sights? Well, the thing about sights is you fire them, you get them aligned so that they work. Yeah. And if you nudge them, like you hit your scope or anything, it's completely out. It will be, you're looking at the target that's off. So holding on a round object onto another round object, that's the barrel, with straps, well, it's going to move. It's going to be really inaccurate, and you've got no sights on it. It just would not work. And then he's like, "Oh, I think it's meant to be a homage to the epic 1970 film where Mercer from the artillery says, 'Can we open fire on him?' And he says, 'No, you can't. We've got things to do. They engage in a duel.'
Right.
And then he does it anyway.
Yeah. And then he shoots a weird looking hole in Napoleon's hat.
Yeah. To like almost kill him. And I think I've gone from like laughing, groaning, laughing again, head in my hands when I saw the sniper rifle, let's call it. And when he takes the shot, I think I just threw my hands into the air and laughed. And there were other laughs.
A wave of emotions in that
race. Yeah. I mean, mostly comic. It just wasn't recognizable. It wasn't even the ridges because they weren't the farmhouses. They had trenches. They were too close together. The Prussians come in from the wrong angle. There wasn't the variation in uniform. Wellington's not riding around. It's the longest battle scene. And so they either could have simplified it or they could have gone more in depth. Right. What you see is like the worst video game version of Waterloo.
Right.
It's somewhere between embarrassing / insulting to the guys who fought.
I
think it really could have been cut. And then Rupert Everett as Wellington. So I want to like Rupert Everett as Wellington. When I saw the photos of him, I was like, "Ah, oh, she's not bad likeness." You just get like the two lines, which to be fair, he did kind of say, which is like, "Oh, well, he's just a peasant, an upstart, and he just looks like he doesn't really want to be there. He's just like looking down on Napoleon." And again, no military prowess, just stands there.
Yeah, and refers to Napoleon as vermin twice. I'm like, okay, we get it.
You don't like him. I mean, I sympathize. I don't like him either, but do something. You know, you're the Duke of Wellington. Lead your troops. Give some orders. But instead, he just stands next to a sniper, which he didn't have. And it's weird. And I didn't enjoy it. I really, really didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, and he's like, "On the penalty of death, you will not fire on him." And the guy does it anyways. Yeah.
Does it anyway. And then slightly misses. I can't think of what there was in that scene, like long scenes, that was accurate.
Yeah.
I don't think it was an entertaining battle. It's not like when they got into hand-to-hand combat, it was something, you know, Braveheart. Famously inaccurate, but when they're getting into hand-to-hand combat, that's quite entertaining. Same as Gladiator, you know, they're throwing people over their shoulders.
You're right. There was none of that.
But they're all fighting in the valley, so do something with it, Ridley Scott. You know, make me feel through the eyes of a 17-year-old conscript who's got his bayonet on for the first time, and then he gets kills someone, and then he gets killed, and he sees his friend die next to him, or I don't know. Give me something. Yeah.
Give me something. Like even Return of the Jedi, they had two Ewoks die and you like felt bad.
Yeah. You still feel bad about the second Ewok. Right.
You know, they should have just thrown an Ewok in the scene and fine.
At the Battlefield Museum at Waterloo, go visit. It's really good. They tell some of the story through the eyes of a French drummer boy who survives the battle. And then like the end shot is him with a drum. Banging, surrounded by his dead friends, crying.
Yeah.
That gave me far more feels than Sir Ridley Scott.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they just kind of, you know, the one part they did get right, Napoleon lost the battle, and they just kind of show him, like, you know, yeah, going.
I was half expecting him to win at this point. It's so badly done. And he flies out on a Chinook. Oh, no, wait, no, they cut that scene. Right. It's just bad. There is nothing to like about it. I didn't find it entertaining. I found it more funny.
Right.
And I probably missed saying something negative about it when we think back. You know, it's that bad.
Just so my audience knows, you are a Battlefield tour guide, and this is like a holy ground for you. How many times have you been to Waterloo, do you think?
At least 7, 8, 9 times. I've guided there 4 times at least, mostly to military groups. I've been involved, you know, about the Napoleonic Revolutionary War Graves charity that I'm a trustee of. I've helped support, and I do support Waterloo Uncovered, which is a great charity that does archaeology on the battlefield using veterans and part of their rehabilitation. And though I'm not involved with them, I support them, and they do great projects. And shout out to all of them and all the veterans, and Tony Pollard, Stuart Eve, and there's so many more to name. Great people. Right. And it's borderline insulting.
Right. This is a hallowed ground to you. This is a very special battle.
Oh, yeah, hugely. When I do my guided tours, I finish with a 1 minute silence. You know, there's about 25,000 people died and dead and wounded at the end of the day. Wellington famously cries. You know, Waterloo means something big to me. I know reenactors who've had their ashes scattered there because it means something to them. It means something to a lot of people.
Yeah.
It drew the map of Europe. Waterloo matters.
Yeah, if you read accounts of it, it was hell on earth for 10, 15 hours. Like, it was just a devastating battle. And I just didn't get that feel from the
movie. Didn't get that. I know that Napoleon's actually quite ill for lots of it, but your man, you're a fan of Ney, he's riding all around the place. He's doing loads.
Yeah.
The 95th are doing lots, but they're in a sand pit. That's not shown. La Haissance is held by the King's German Legion.
Yeah. No mention of Grouchy, none of that. Yeah.
No mention of Grouchy. Blücher just kind of comes in. You could have done it all very differently, but just not like that. No.
Okay.
It's gone from a film that wasn't holding my attention and was mildly funny and starting to get boring to just bad now. And that's why I'm saying 4 stars, but I'd actually be pushing it down to like 3 if it wasn't for some of the earlier bits. If it wasn't for Vanessa Kirby's acting, I'd be going, it's like a 2-star film. And it's not just the history's bad because it's tripe, but it's not entertaining. And I want the film to be fun. The Star Wars battles with Ewoks is a better battle scene. Go watch that. It's closer to Waterloo, right?
They should just cut to that, like the Ewok battle. You know,
oh, man. I'm now feeling emotional about the dead Ewok.
Yeah, exactly. No,
it really, I cannot understate. If I'm missing something, I'll hold my hands up and say I'm missing it. But I think I went back and watched it again, which I'd struggle to do until the big version comes out, I think I'd find more to dislike about the Waterloo scene. I really feel like it was
let's wrap up, just because the movie's almost over at this point.
Thankfully.
There's 2 more ridiculous scenes we have to
start. Oh, yeah.
Napoleon obviously abdicates a second time.
Right.
And we see him on a boat having dinner, using utensils. There's some, looks like cabin boys watching him eat. And then Wellington strides in. I do you want to talk about this scene? I don't even know what to say about it.
Yeah, so he's on what is one of the world's most recognizable ships, HMS Victory in Portsmouth. Again, caveat, I used to work in Portsmouth Historic Dockyards as part of that museum, so I know it relatively well. Mm-hmm. It's very recognizable. You know, it's like you say, having the outside of the Notre Dame earlier, you recognize it's the Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm.
And it's meant to be, I believe, the Bellerophon, if not HMS Northumberland. So one of the ships, they were definitely smaller than Victory and it wouldn't have had a cabin that size. And Wellington walks in, hits his head on a beam, which is like, is that maybe funny? I don't know. Yeah. It's the Duke of Wellington hitting his head, maybe. There's a thing to be said earlier before we came on. We're like, the props department, they hide some things quite well in Malta. They hide like a public telephone box behind loads of posters. That's done well. Victory, for sensible reasons, has got loads of sprinklers on board because we don't want to lose the ship to fire.
Mm-hmm.
And you see all the sprinklers and all the pipes and all like the fire alarms. It's like, put a bit of cloth over it, guys. Hide it. And then they have a conversation.
Now, I've tried to do the maths before. The closest Napoleon and Wellington get is probably just before the Imperial, or during the Imperial Guard attacks. Napoleon rides up to just south of La Haye Sainte, and Wellington is roughly around the area where today the Lion's Mound is. So it's less than half a mile.
Yeah. A couple hundred yards.
A couple hundred meters. It's in that vicinity. It's under a mile, definitely.
Okay.
They do not have breakfast.
I the only thing I can think in my head is that as entertainment, you got to have a scene where, getting back to Star Wars, Luke Skywalker meets Darth Vader, or Billy the Kid meets Pat Garrett. You got to have the good and the bad meet, I guess. Maybe that's what they were doing.
And that's what they're doing. I'm happy to take Napoleon being the bad guy and Wellington to be the savior if you want to give it to me.
Sure.
However, Wellington's been in this film for so little, it doesn't have that crescendo.
Right.
I don't, you know, it's not like we've been following Wellington's career, because they don't meet, you know, they don't fight. The only good thing from that scene is Napoleon talks about his desire to retire as an English country gent. He says, I think I like the Cotswolds. And he does say something along those lines. He believes the British government will give him an estate and some land in England. And he's massively deluded.
Right.
To think that's where I think the movie's trying to go. Having Wellington there doesn't really add anything to that.
No.
And it's a bit awkward. He's like eating breakfast and
Like, if you're going to have that scene, have some really biting dialogue or something intriguing, but it's almost like a throwaway scene. Like, why is that here?
I think Rupert Everett's lines, you know, would have been cutting if they'd met as a what if. I don't know. I can never be in the mind of one of those men, but I think they would have been a lot more snide to each other, cutting, maybe even angry.
Right.
Just not this kind of like calm breakfast where he's like, oh, by the way, you're going to exile.
Yeah. Yeah. And
what was that? I don't know why it was put in. They could have still had him on the Bellerophon. That's fine. That's a nice shot of him watching out to sea. Yeah. Just one of those things. Again, by this point, I've given up effectively watching the film. I'm like, cool.
You're almost walking out of the movie theater at this point.
Yeah, I think I was really struggling. I'm really blasé about it. It's just, we've suspended disbelief so far, but I'm not entertained. I'm not in historic. And we're going to go to St. Helena.
Yeah, all right.
And I thought, because the opening shot on St. Helena is a close-up of the wallpaper. And I was like, no, please don't give us the arsenic wallpaper. Please don't. I was begging.
No, they didn't do that.
They didn't do that, thankfully.
They showed two girls having a sword fight with sticks, two young girls.
And yeah, I believe one of them is Betsy Balcombe, who's the daughter of one of the officers there. And Napoleon did build up a relationship with Betsy Balcombe.
That
was a thing.
No, the scene's fine, you know, and he briefly mentions how his marshals let him down and how he burned Moscow, or how the Russians did. And then he falls over dead. It's just such an odd
I mean, if you're being really generous, you could argue, oh, he's not falling over dead. He's falling over from his many bouts of ill health. But that's not what they show. They show him fall sideways like a cartoon character.
Yeah.
Like fully 90 degrees. If you were feeling really ill and you're at a table, you'd fall forwards or backwards, not just off the chair.
Yeah.
And then it's just got the end script of like Napoleon died.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminded me of Godfather 3, which nobody saw, but at the end, Michael Corleone just kind of falls over and that's the end of the movie. And it's like, all right, you know, I guess we're done now, you know, and there's some postscript about, you know, Napoleon's reign and this and that. It was just an odd ending.
It was an odd ending. I thought they were going to give us, again, one of the famous paintings of Napoleon on his deathbed surrounded by his entourage.
That would have been cool. That would have been cool.
Yeah. Like, it would have shown who's there, who's not there. They didn't show many of those characters in the film, so it would have been difficult kind of to be like, oh, these people there. They could have done it wrong and shown us with Ney and Josephine's face and things like that. They show then in the postscript his last words. Yep. France, army, Josephine.
Yeah.
Again, why I think it should have been a Josephine and Napoleon film.
Yep.
And then they show a list of the deaths caused in his battles.
Right.
But only like five battles, which is a bit strange.
Yeah.
Then there's a bit that's like quite anti-Bonaparte, which is like, oh, and all these men died because of Napoleon. I was like,
that
pleases me a little bit. I slightly agree, but I think like some people are going to rip you apart for that.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know why that had to be in there. I didn't like that, really, Scott, just for the record, if you're listening.
You're going to upset a lot of people with that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right, so we're through this movie, and I did read another review that was kind of accurate. Like, why can't Hollywood get Napoleon's story right? Because as you mentioned, there's a 1970 story, Waterloo. There's been other attempts to get this story down. And somebody said maybe Napoleon's life is too epic. Like, it's so unbelievable that it's hard to put on a screen.
Maybe, but they've done it with other people. Mm-hmm. You know, there's other biographies, and you know, it's maybe I'm saying that because I'm not a big fan of Napoleon.
Yeah.
I'm always trying to be open about my bias. But if you can do other films about other great people, I'm sure they can do that. When I first heard about this film, I don't know when they first announced it, 2.5-3 years ago, it was meant to be about his rise to power.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if it roughly ended with his coronation,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, Austerlitz maybe soon after, yeah. That would have been about right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, narrow your scope. We're talking about sharpshooters before, like just kind of focus in on one area. Like, I would have loved it if it was just the building of the bridge over the Berezina and how we got there. Like, that would have been interesting too.
They could have just done basically the Russian campaign. We could have just done roughly 1810, the build up and all of that bit to 1813 and the retreat.
Yeah. And cut
3 years. There's so many stories to tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could have done one battle, or again, like I said many times tonight, you could have just done him and Josephine, but I think what it comes down to for me is, by putting in another 2 hours of footage, this isn't going to make the film better by right. telling more stories. Even if they suddenly give an hour of Italy, let's be honest, this film would not be safe if they put an hour of Peninsula War in, and I'd love that a lot.
I was going to say, if they added another 20 minutes of Waterloo, you might have
less Waterloo. Honestly,
right.
Waterloo should have just been them looking at each other through their telescopes and then fade to black. Done.
Exactly. The rain stops, and then that's it. That's the end.
Just cut to Napoleon leaving, and I mean, he doesn't even leave correctly. He leaves on his horse, and he his carriage, and Wellington crying at the battle. But I mean, that would have actually, the human connection there would have been better. If they put in more footage of Waterloo, it can only make it worse. That's how bad it was.
Well,
I think the film didn't know what it wanted. Your analogy of a bus journey is right, but it feels a bit like the bus driver got like the map wrong.
Or he got drunk.
Let's talk about it. You know, Ridley Scott coming out and telling academics or historians, you know, I never label myself one, but he's telling people that they don't know what they're talking about because they weren't there.
Right.
Now, who is going to see a film about Napoleon? It's going to be people interested in Napoleon's life.
Yeah.
That's your target audience.
Yeah. And history doesn't end just when Napoleon dies. Like, you know, memoirs are found, like Marshall McDonald's or Marbot's, or General Gudin's body is found in Russia in 2019. Like, it doesn't end just because there's no book coming out about Napoleon that's new. Like, there's always things we're learning about this time era. And I think for him to say that was kind of off base.
Yeah, I think it alienated so many people there. It was... getting people's backs up before they've seen the film, which is a really bad idea.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's marking it out to be one of the bad films of the year rather than one of the epics.
Yeah.
And you're going, here's a director who doesn't care about his target market. You know, he's not going, oh, well, it's a kid's film, so I don't mind about
the historians. People...
It's not a kid's film. It's for people who enjoy the era.
Some people liked it, though. I see these critics who are like, awesome, epic movie of the year. And I'm like, what movie? Maybe they saw the 4-hour version. I don't know.
I've only seen, I think, like two historians who said I liked it. And I have to say to them in the nicest way, because obviously I respect their opinion. They've probably got some much more in-depth knowledge of areas than I don't. But I really say, really? Did we watch the same film? Like, I just, apart from costumes, locations...
Yeah, weapons were semi-accurate.
Weapons okay, Vanessa Kirby's acting.
Yeah.
Some of the animal support acting was good, the horses and dogs, genuinely, because I know it's very difficult to do. That was actually
lots
good.
Lots of dogs.
There's lots of dogs. I like the dogs.
It's like I said in the beginning of this episode, I'm not a filmmaker. Ridley Scott's made some great films. No. And Could I make a better Napoleon movie? Probably not, because I'm not a filmmaker. But I almost want to get with Marcus and Bookish Rachel and Dr. Zach White and just write our own movie and see if it could be better than this.
I think it's disappointed so many people. And that's what I'm also really going up on. If I say to you, I'm disappointed in you, that's cutting. Mm-hmm. Because I don't get angry very easily.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of people who are like, finally, we're getting a 21st century Napoleon movie. You know, the last like few have been early 20th century. There's famously a black and white silent movie about him.
Yep.
Like, we're going to get the big one with the special effects, the thousands of extras. It's going to look really cool.
Yeah.
This isn't it. And like, one of my good friends texted me earlier saying, this was the opportunity to have an amazing film about a fascinating character. This isn't it.
Now, with that said, and I sent you the article before, it has made a good deal of money this weekend. Now, it's opening weekend, and I'm happy to hear that, because maybe they'll make other films for this era. What did I say? $200 million already or something like that?
So I think you said it's taken $75 million. Yep. The budget was $200 million, so apparently it has to take like $400 million is the maths. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong. Like, when there's a World War I film that comes out, all the World War I historians are like, oh, that patch is wrong. They didn't have that bayonet until later.
Right.
And they can, because there's a lot of stuff you can do with kit, because you can see the date that it was issued. You can see it's trained on it. You can get really nerdy about that.
Right.
I can get nerdy about kit. I like, you know, the sniper rifle is an exception because it's like a homebrew thing.
Right.
The rest of the kit seems pretty good.
Yeah.
I didn't go out with a magnifying glass. It seemed like it was done quite well by the military historical advisors. I want Napoleonic films. I want something done about, let's do one about Murat or Ney. I want one on Wellington's spy master, Cole Cahoon Grant. I heard a rumor there's one about Nelson. I actually prefer ones about less famous people. Give me one about a guy called Sergeant Lawrence in the Peninsula War, or a Rifleman Harris. You know, give me one about the ordinary soldiers.
Yeah. And I think Spielberg's working on a 7-part series, so I'm anxious to see what that turns.
Yeah, but we're giving it on Napoleon, and I'm like, give somebody else a go. I don't know. I want Wellington. It doesn't have to be Wellington. There's so many characters out there. Do Talleyrand, do Fouché, you know, Spymaster. There's loads of good. I mean, that's wrong. There's thousands of great stories out there.
That's the basis of my podcast, is all these supporting characters.
All those men and women. And the best thing about this film is that Josephine, I think, was well acted.
Yeah, just underwhelming. And I went in with a low bar. I went in like, you know, and I read reviews. And, all right, maybe it won't be that bad. But it was, I don't even know what to say. It's fine for entertainment. If you don't know about Napoleon, it's maybe can bring you up to speed a little bit about him. But for you and I, who know a lot about him, it was kind of underwhelming.
Yeah, and I don't know if you knew next to nothing about Napoleon other than he was like a general, he was a guy, or as I once had a American tourist, sorry for you to say this, American tourist say to me, oh, is he the guy who's married to Marie Antoinette and fought the battle by Waterloo Station? I'm like, that's some people's base knowledge. That's what they think.
Right, and, with the funny hat, short guy. Yeah, exactly.
And you kind of, okay, at least they're in the right place. At least they're interested. We're talking about it. Would they come out? Yes, probably. They'll probably know more about Napoleon. I think they'll probably come out being anti-Napoleon. Now, is that a good thing? That's a whole different discussion. But they would have got a lot of very strange information, very mixed stuff. If it opens up more people to learning about the era, you know, downloading podcasts, other films, going visit some battlefields, all that's good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But
I just don't think it's the film that's doing that. I don't
know. No, the bones are there. Like I said, like, there's good scenes, but the movie itself doesn't come together.
No, I was just so disappointed. I really did try to go in with an open mind, knowing that, you know, there's going to be bits of Napoleon's life I don't know about. So it'd be like, oh, that could have happened. Yeah, I've read like 3 or 4 biographies of him. There's loads of other ones. There's much more information, other documentaries, other podcasts that I probably haven't listened to every single one, because that's not my area. And I'm just like, yeah, but you failed to entertain me. You failed to hold close enough to some semblance of history on the big important things. And I'd say that many people who really know about anything about Napoleon, they probably know that Waterloo, whether the battle was fought at the train station or in Belgium. We come away just thinking Napoleon's an egomaniac
who, he might have had a second wife. Don't really hear anything about her. He was a bit strange in the bedroom. And at the end of the day, him and Wellington had a funny breakfast. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, he doesn't come off as a brilliant man at all. No, like,
he really doesn't.
He could, he was probably the best multitasker in the world. Like, he, you know, in the same conversation with the secretaries, he could talk about, you know, taxation system of the central bank and the rules for a new boarding school in France and the strategy of the army in the field and how many soldiers Berthier needs for supplies and cannons. And he just had a remarkable capacity for delegating and giving orders and handling things. And they don't show any of that.
We don't get any of that. Every battle just kind of is him stood in the cannon line shouting fire. I mean, famously, he helps sight cannons, you know, look along the barrels. He doesn't do that in the film. He just kind of fires a cannon and the battle's over. We don't get any of his detail. We don't get some of the more controversial bits, like his massacres, his looting. So we don't get the great, we don't get the evil.
And
with Wellington, we don't get him being a strategic master. He just stands there. We don't go in depth with anybody, and I don't think more hours of footage is going to do that. I think it's
no Porto at all. No Battle of Porto.
I would have been very surprised if we suddenly get 2 hours added in for the Battle of Porto. which, having seen the Waterloo and Austerlitz, so, you know, they're probably crossing the boats in helicopters.
Yeah, God, they would have massacred that.
They'd massacre that so badly. Yeah. So, if you haven't seen it, maybe save your dollars and wait for it to come out.
Well, thank you, my friend. That was very comprehensive. I think we covered just about all bases there. And we'll probably have to do a second episode when the 4-hour version comes out.
Yeah, I'll probably force myself to watch it, but probably in like two sittings. And I think if that's coming up to it going, you're a fan of the man in the era, I'm a fan of the era and his defeat, let's say, I wouldn't watch that film again. Some encouragement.
For no other reason, I want to see what ended up on the cutting room floor. Like, true. Maybe those were the better scenes than the one he put in, you know?
Correct. Yeah, what's there? But I have slight anticipation about that.
Yeah, I get it. Well, again, if you guys want to check out more about Marcus Cribb, please check him out on Twitter or on dukeofwellington.org. And thank you, my friend. That was great.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed getting that off my chest as well. And hopefully people... we'll take away their own sides from that as well.
Yeah, indeed.
I won't win the debate.
Thanks again, Marcus. I appreciate it.
Thank you, my friend.